worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. We cover news and public issues that affect areas students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. It's July 4th weekend and the 250th anniversary of our nation. That got me thinking about what it means to be an American, what the American dream is, and an immigrant's journey, what values we hold dear, and how closely are we meeting those ideals? The promise of America is that we can expect freedom and justice for all. We can dream for a brighter future and have faith that through hard work and perseverance, that dream can actually be realized. Our country is one of ambition, of hope, of justice. Now, I know that a lot of that ambition and justice are yet to be realized, and some say that we're in one of the country's darkest periods. Considering our students and faculty are off for the summer, I want to focus the first part of the show today on how I have witnessed the American dream being realized with my own eyes, both in my family's journey and in my own. Let's start with my mom's story. Hers is the one I tell my students about at the start of many semesters. And I tell them, you know, you can read my bio or my resume, but to really know me, you have to know the story of my mom. She was born in India and raised me in Chicago as a single mother.
Our students
she worked
the
in
summer,
a factory in Chicago, piecing little parts together from light bulbs
content.
Used in x-ray machines.
So
one day, her
I'm
friend Rita Neely told her, child, you don't belong here. Rita knew that my mom didn't have a college degree, but she could see that my mom was bright and had a whole future ahead of her. So she encouraged my mom to take community college classes. My mom ended up enrolling in accounting classes. After working all day, she picked me up from the babysitters and checked my homework, then did hers and woke up early the next morning to start the routine all over again. I thought, if she can muster the energy to do all of that, I can at least try to do well in school and make her happy. Her accounting classes helped her make the move from the factory floor to the office next door, and she slowly worked her way up to a junior accountant and then up the ladder in finance. She did all that while hating math. She chose accounting knowing that there would almost always be jobs in that field, even during a recession. I learned a lot from that. I learned that if my mom could achieve all she did, given the circumstances and challenges she faced, I can work hard and do the same. Also, unlike her, I had the privilege to attend a four-year university and pursue a career I was passionate about. That was a luxury. One I didn't want to take lightly. So I was careful in taking different classes and seeing what inspires me, what's meaningful to me. I chose a profession, journalism and teaching, that I loved and that means a lot to me. Now, let's hear from my mom, in her own words, describing her first days in the U.S. and her own sense of the American dream.
Coming to U.S. in 1974, I was excited to be with my ex-husband. Also, I was excited to see the new world, be part of it, study, and make myself of something. And a lot of dreams. Everything was new. I was putting footstep outside of India for the first time alone. Without my family, which was the hardest part. Sitting at a dining tables alone, eating dinner was hard because we had a big family, and leaving that family behind to do new beginnings was hard. But the dream was to make myself into something and get a home. Initially, it was hard. I studied. I started, instead of going to college, I started a keyboard class. I practiced on my English so I could speak well. And I found a job. We moved from New York to Chicago, and I found a job in a factory because we needed the money. So I started in a factory, and it didn't feel like any less work because I was making money and I didn't mind doing any work. And it was fun. I got to meet people. Initially, it was hard because the people I worked with, they were from Mexico mostly. I practiced on my English more. I learned some Spanish. And it was fun to exchange lunches and do potlucks and working toward the dream of, right, making a life in United States. Coming up the rank was harder than I thought. Even with the education, changing supervisors, changing work habits, it was hard. But I did it, and I'm retired now, and I couldn't have chosen a better country to fulfill my dreams. I have my kids and my kids' grandkids, and I'm very happy, and I'm content, and I don't have any regrets. I think I made my life the way I wanted it.
Thanks so much to my mom, Naina Patel Mandalia, for sharing that story and for all she does for me. Now I'm going to go into my dad's story as an immigrant. That one's a little different because it includes some dark moments, and it points to some of our failings in the U.S., like corporate greed, the lack of accountability, and the allure of get-rich-quick schemes in a capitalist society. Now, I wouldn't have known that my dad actually did achieve his own version of the American dream unless I interviewed him the year before his death. We first aired my reflection on my dad in December 2024, 1 month after he died. I often tell my students about my mom's journey, from working on the factory floor and moving up to the office, and how much that inspired me to pursue my own passions and career. I rarely talk about my dad, Vinod Bhatrabhai Patel, a retired cabbie in Vegas who died last month at age 77. I remember meeting up with him about once a week after the divorce, and staying with him in what could only be described now as a fleabag motel. It was a tiny room with one shared bathroom down the hall. I remember days spent riding around with him in his taxi cab, getting to see different parts of the city, seeing the skyscrapers. It seemed he always got better tips with me in the front seat. And then, within a year of the divorce, he moved, abruptly, to New York City. The next summer, he asked if I'd like to spend the summer with him. The problem was my grandparents had already planned to bring me to India for my aunt's wedding, so I said no. That upset him, and I didn't see or hear from him for the next few years. When I was in junior high, he had moved to Vegas and invited me to spend the summer with him. So I did. One summer, I even brought a friend with me. I have fond memories of those summers. He taught me how to play tennis, and that's why I played in high school. He taught me how to cook, how to make a mean chicken curry, and a healthy version of gajra nahalwa, an Indian dessert made with carrots. My friend Natalie was aghast at his living conditions in a small one-bedroom apartment. It was in a motel-like building near the Stratosphere, a rundown area at the time. But even she got used to eating Crisco sandwiches or whatever odd meals he gave us, as long as she had her Evian water or Diet Coke with it. Since moving to California 7 years ago, I have dragged my kids and husband Seth to Vegas at least once a year to visit my dad. I knew our time was limited because of his age, so I wanted to make sure I spent time with him and that my kids could get to know him a little. Most of our visits were rushed, taking my kids to Circus Circus's indoor theme park or having lunch somewhere near his place with my much younger half-brother and half-sister. But last summer, I let loose with questions that had haunted me for years. Why did he and my mom send me to live with my grandparents in India for the first few years of my life? Why did he leave Chicago for New York after the divorce? Here's my dad in his own words, just over a year ago.
As far as I remember, we both agreed that Julie should go over there. And Julie, her grandfather, was very fond of her. And Julie was also very fond of her grandfather and all other people living over there. And we always wanted Julie back here. And so we only let her live over there for 3 years. And then she came back.
And this is what he said about moving to New York.
What happened was, from Chicago, I lost my job. And I gave my cab to somebody else, to park somebody else's home, to park. And when I was away, he drove the cab and he got caught. And they took my chauffeur license away. So I couldn't drive the taxi over there anymore. So I went to upstate New York. The town name was Poughkeepsie, where my youngest brother lived over there, and my eldest brother lived over there.
I don't know what I expected, but his answers were reasonable. The exercise reminded me why I love my chosen profession, journalism and teaching, so much. They give you a chance to ask questions, and to learn, and to see things differently than you previously did. My students and I have been talking recently about a term, stereotype, coined by Walter Lippmann, who wrote a canonical book in our industry called Public Opinion. We talked about confirmation biases and how challenging it can be to break down our previous experiences and perceptions and see the nuance in issues. My kids once overheard my husband and I talking about my dad and how he mistreated my mom. "How could you still want to see him?" they asked. In their minds, he had become what people generally would call a deadbeat dad. But his answers to the questions I posed, layered on top of all the other information I have about him, helped me in recent years to see him in a new light. For one thing, we always talked about politics. He was a lifelong Democrat. I remember his outrage about issues like how my brother didn't seem to learn much in some of his high school classes, and how his grade was changed to a C just so he could stay on the football team. My dad also wanted the for-profit chemistry program that brought him to the U.S. exposed as a scam. It's no longer in business, but he alleged that it took federal funding for students, but barely taught them anything. He said I thought I should do investigative stories about these issues, and I took it for face value. What I didn't realize is that gave me information I needed to understand the complexities of his life. All I had to do was apply the theories I learned in school to the stories he told me, and I would see a fuller picture of him. Except I didn't. Not for a long time. It's a lot easier to understand things in distinct categories, good and bad, black and white, wrong and right, even as a gender studies major, or maybe especially as one. It's easy to get into this trap of moral self-righteousness and avoid questioning yourself or thinking more deeply about issues you think are givens or knowns. Thinking about him now, I realize he wasn't set up to succeed. Not in India, where his parents were dirt poor and had too many kids to really put time into him and guide him. And not in the U.S., where he was fired from his job as a chemist because of a sham degree he got. That's the dark side of capitalism that my students and I have talked about. The difficulty of upward mobility in a system that is so profit-oriented. I always thought it was interesting and cool how much he embraced being a cabbie. And at the same time, how informed and political he was. To me, there was contradiction in that. The ultimate blue-collar, mustache guy with his iconic trucker hat who loved football, beer, and fast food. That contrasted with his keen interest and knowledge of public policy, his love of lifelong learning. But now I realize those two aspects of him likely fed each other. His awareness of inequities he faced may have actually led him to embrace his blue-collar lifestyle.
I grew up in a very extremely poor conditions. We didn't have electricity at home. And all my study came with a lantern. At nighttime, I used to use lantern. We had a two-room apartment, and we were five brothers, one sister, and a father and mother. So that many people, we live in a two-room apartment. And at that time, our rent was 11 rupees a month, which is in today's exchange rate, it's about a quarter, 25 cents a month. I was happy, but otherwise I did not learn rights and wrongs of the life. Nobody bothered to teach me, and nobody had a time, because we are five brothers and one sister. So we are very crowded family. I was a very shy kid when I was growing up. But last 2 years of my high school, I decided I want to go to America. So I really, really worked hard, and I got A grades, and that's how I got the admission in the school.
Dad says he didn't learn much at the school. It was more of a degree mill that wanted to graduate a lot of students to qualify for government funds.
I had to do all the art jobs, and then I drove taxi cab for 35 years, 9 years in Chicago, and 27 years in Las Vegas. And I had to talk to people, and I learned a lot from the people who sits in my cab. And all I had to do is listen when they talk. And I learned a lot.
He used some of that knowledge the past few years to draft a book that quizzes readers on politics, science, history, and other subjects.
Now I keep myself very busy writing my book, and I have a really good time writing my book. I'm blessed to have wonderful kids, Julie and the other two kids, and Michelle, and the other one is Richard. And now I'm very, very happy. I live a very quiet life. And that's where I am.
The last time I saw my dad was at my brother's wedding in late October. He almost left without saying goodbye. When I saw that he wasn't at his seat, I ran to the hallway and got him in time. I said bye, gave him a hug, and he said, "I love you, Julie." Finally, I asked my 11-year-old Eitan if he wanted to share his feelings about the 250th anniversary of our great nation and what his thoughts are on being American and the American dream. So here's Eitan Liss.
The American dream was a phrase first coined by James Truslow Adams in 1931 of his Epic of America. It spread rapidly like fire, and millions of people emigrated to America in hopes of getting to experience this. This was in the midst of the Great Depression, which was a severe economic downturn all around the world. To understand why this phrase attracted so many people, we first need to understand what we get in America that sometimes we take for granted. In Afghanistan, girls are banned from education beyond sixth grade. Half of all children there suffer from acute food poverty. This condition is volatile and life-threatening. That's according to Kabul Now, an online newspaper that started in Kabul and is now based in the United States. In North Korea, a system is used so that your food, education, and living conditions are essentially determined before you are born. Even worse, children like me may be forced to do child labor. That's all according to Human Rights Watch's website. And UNICEF reports that Sudan is also an extremely dangerous place to live in as a kid. Food crises and famine causes starvation and malnutrition. The civil war violence affects the people, but so does the socioeconomic aspect. Many children may not have the jobs and opportunities that we do. The American dream tells us that in America, if you work hard, you can become successful. Even though I'm 11, I feel like I've already experienced some of this. I wanted a tough, challenging education, because I enjoy learning, and sometimes I get bored when too much time is spent on other things, or if I already know the material being taught. For these reasons, I decided to look for a more rigorous school. I found one that I could get into. It was difficult to get accepted with 5 hours of testing, an interview, and a short essay, but I got in. The choices we have living in the States, combined with the quality of life, most people having food and shelter and an opportunity to be educated, represent our freedom and ability to pursue and succeed at our passions and goals. This isn't to say the American dream is unthreatened. When decisions are made like undermining parts of the Affordable Care Act and not providing housing assistance for mixed status immigrant families, the American dream starts to fade. This summer, I visited Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty with my parents. There's a quote by Emma Lazarus in the statue. Part of it reads, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest toast, to me. I will lift my lamp beside the golden door." To me, that means everyone. The tired, poor, and homeless have a chance to rise up and control how they live. They have a chance to succeed and do what they love, as long as we accept them with open arms.
Thank you so much, Eitan. Know from the story of my mom achieving the American dream that her hard work gave me the opportunity to achieve what I wanted to in life, starting with getting the very best education and to spend my career as a journalist and now as an educator. But I want to share some other formative moments for me as an American. My college radio station, WHPK 88.5 FM, which collaborated with the community on content, had a true public service and community mission. My professors at UChicago and Stanford pushed us to think about how to focus on doing the right thing, how to serve the public good. And through the books they chose to have us read and the discussions that led to, they encouraged us to pursue a life of service as the most meaningful way to live. To me, that's also what it means to be an American. to think about other people, to think of the greater good, and to try in our own way to make a small impact. That's partly why I decided to start my career right out of college by joining an AmeriCorps program called City Year. Instead of serving the country by joining the military, City Year and AmeriCorps were other ways to serve our country, cities, and neighborhoods through community service work. We were paid only $300 a month, less than a living wage, to work in schools around Chicago with a small but incredibly diverse team of other Corps members. And we were richly compensated in other ways. My team included three people I'm still in occasional touch with all these years later, including Sherry Willis, who grew up in public housing and was a single mother when we did City Year. She later became a chef and worked in a school cafeteria in Chicago, raising a big, beautiful family. Another teammate of ours, Olivia Tellez, is Mexican-American, lesbian, and works as a comedian. Our team leader, Erin White, had been a sorority sister at University of Illinois before doing City Year, and she's now a senior training and development coordinator at University of Texas in Austin. The year we did City Year together, we did everything together. We struggled through obstacles like losing two of our teammates to issues and hardships in their lives. We created engaging after-school curricula, like an oral histories project where students interviewed senior citizens, producing these dazzling anecdotes and stories about Chicago's neighborhoods that we'd never know about otherwise. Soon after, I headed to California for grad school, and as my classmates and I started covering stories in the area, we noticed the disparities between Palo Alto, where Stanford is, and East Palo Alto, on the other side of the highway. This included a lack of a newspaper to engage people in public issues in East Palo Alto. So we reached out to community members, and I learned of a resident who was working to create a newspaper. Her name was Henrietta Burrows, so I worked with her and helped her with those efforts the next couple of years. My full-time job was at the San Jose Mercury News. I was a one-year fellow covering race and demographics. It was my dream beat. I believed stories on that beat mattered. I quickly learned through covering a range of stories that pursuing public records, being a watchdog, analyzing data, doing investigative reporting to reveal issues that affect people was yet another form of social justice reporting. In fact, these were the stories that seemed to lead to systemic changes. And so I pivoted to focus more on watchdog stories on my beat and later worked as an investigative reporter. I came full circle in my career about 8 years ago when I decided to pursue a career in academia. And to me, this was just another way to make an impact on people's lives, hopefully train some of our future reporters to do great public service journalism. So much of my career, from the mentorship programs I volunteered for to the stories I pursued, was aimed at making a positive difference, amplifying the voices of undercovered or marginalized communities. And I think that's why the past few years have been so difficult for me as the wife of a Jewish man and the mother of Jewish children. Our family was in shock and felt utter despair seeing how Hamas slaughtered nearly 1,200 civilians and kidnapped another 240 people on October 7th. Meanwhile, Hamas official Ghazi Hamad was quoted in the press saying the terrorist organization has plans to repeat that deadly attack. Quote, "Israel is a country that has no place in our land," Hamad said, according to a translation from the Middle East Media Research Institute. Quote, "We must remove that country because it constitutes a security, military, and political catastrophe to the Arab and Islamic nation and must be finished. We must teach Israel a lesson, and we will do this again and again." End quote. Hamad added that the terrorist group did not intend to harm civilians during its attack. Still, that was terrifying to hear. It felt like we just went through another September 11th. The 9/11 attack killed about 3,000 people. October 7th was 13 times the size of that when adjusted for Israel's much smaller population. So it was just devastating. And I assumed that many others in the U.S. would feel the same way. But when I walked onto campus 2 days later, I didn't find empathy for the civilians murdered at a music festival or those slaughtered in their communal living arrangements called a kibbutz. And in class, before we even had a chance to have a full discussion about the issue, the one voice I heard was a student who raised his fist and said, quote, "Free Palestine. Free Palestine all the way." Now, our journalism students are trained to try to understand multiple perspectives, and our student newspaper editors were balanced, and they did try capturing multiple truths and perspectives. But other students on campus and activists who came to our campus from outside organizations seemed to have made up their minds a long time ago. They organized pro-Palestine protests and a 1.5 month long encampment. There were signs on campus reading, "Divest now," "Free Gaza by any means," "From the river to the sea," and "F America and Israel." The encampment on our campus was eventually dismantled after protesters, likely from outside the Cal State LA campus, overtook the administration building, breaking and toppling outdoor furniture, golf carts, glass walls, and carting out equipment, including a copy machine.
Classes at Cal State LA will be remote today after protesters took over a building on campus and caused all this damage. And we've heard that university employees were inside, might have been trapped when all of this was happening.
So this morning we are seeing all of the damage from broken windows to spray painted walls. They moved out all the furniture. NBC4's Lauren Coronado is live at Cal State LA where protesters were there earlier. Are they still there this morning, Lauren?
Lynette, Adrian, good morning. There are still a few protesters who've been walking around the student services building, which we're outside of right now. I tried talking with them. They didn't want to talk. We've seen that same situation at other university campuses where these protesters aren't too open in talking with us. But I do want to show you the aftermath. All of the vandalism, it's just so bad. Let's get a better look inside the student services building. Those involved just wrecked the place. This is probably the worst we've seen in terms of vandalism on local university campuses. What appears to be red paint splattered everywhere, a glass door shattered, office supplies destroyed, black markings on the walls.
We've been watching for the better part of the last hour as they have begun looting the building. The first floor, we've seen a number of pieces of office furniture, sofas, workstations, computers, copy machines, all coming out, parading out to the front door, through the front door, and then eventually, in many cases, out to the various barriers that they are building. They are building several sets of barricades to block every possible access point to this building.
That audio footage was from news stories by our local NBC and ABC stations. So here's the thing. Jews are one of the smallest minority populations that we serve at Cal State LA and that are left in the world. While surveys show that most American Jews don't support the current political leadership in Israel, nor the extremists in the West Bank, 8 in 10 reported supporting the State of Israel in Pew's last survey on this topic, because it's the only Jewish majority state, and it's considered an ancient indigenous land for them, once called Judea and Samaria, both mentioned in the Bible. The settler versus colonial and white versus brown narrative, pushed by many who oppose a two-state solution, also seems questionable, considering one, Jewish people don't proselytize like other religions that expanded their empires over the centuries and spread their religion by conquests. And in fact, Jewish people make up a tiny fraction of the world's population compared to other religions. Two, there are 120 Christian-majority countries, a handful of Hindu-majority countries, and 50-plus Muslim-majority countries. And as you may know, Jewish communities have been persecuted, attacked, kicked out of many of these countries over the decades. Three, about 20% of the Israeli population is made of Arab Muslims, Christians, Druze, and others who serve in a variety of jobs and roles, including as judges and lawmakers. And four, there are Jews of all ethnicities, black, white, Latino, Arab, Asian. Israel's proponents aren't claiming that it's a perfect country or democracy. There are many fair criticisms of the country, its policies, and its leaders' actions, starting with what some experts say is the disproportional response to the October 7th invasion by Hamas. And there's little doubt that Palestinians have been the biggest victims of Hamas. They've suffered the most. They, too, have deep genetic and historic ties to the land. And everyone deserves their own peaceful place to live. The history is complicated, far too complicated to capture in a radio commentary. But it is history. The thing that can be done now is to look to the future, a brighter one for everyone in the region, where groups aren't controlled by extremists on either side. To do that, there has to be dialogue, and there has to be critical thinking, and there has to be challenging of beliefs on all sides. A question that has gnawed at me the past few years is, where are all the social justice warriors now to defend or at least empathize with this tiny minority fighting for its own existence, seemingly alone or largely alone? Our own faculty union, the California Faculty Association's Los Angeles chapter, shared dozens of posts on its social media channels on freeing Palestine, divestment, and issues related to teaching about all of that. And none acknowledging the devastation caused by October 7th. At the statewide level, the union repeatedly used its energy and resources to travel to Sacramento and fight policies aimed at protecting Jewish American students who have faced significant anti-Semitism across the state since October 7th. From the perspective of a number of Jewish groups and families, this seemed to target a minority population and thereby went against its very own social justice goals, all without consulting regular faculty members for our thoughts on the issue. A union with a diverse membership should probably get broad input, maybe even do surveys from its members before taking policy positions. That's just my opinion. Kenyon Farrow, CFA's Director of Strategic Communications, said, quote, CFA, as an anti-racist social justice union representing the faculty of CSU campuses, sees protecting academic freedom of students and faculty as core to its mission. Over the course of the past several years, we have witnessed the time, place, and manner, or TPM policies, including SB 1287, be disproportionately used against black and brown students and faculty, with penalties that make everyone's ability to practice academic freedom in their places of work and learning far more dangerous. And it is for this reason we have championed bills like AB 2551 in this legislative session. AB 2551 does not prohibit campuses from having time, place, manner policies, but does collect demographic information on TPM complaints, gets feedback from students on TPM policies, and sends a message to campuses that free speech should be protected. We can ensure all campuses are both places where dissenting views can be expressed and the academic freedom rights of students can also be protected. CFA has not taken on this work in a vacuum. We've worked with a coalition with a diverse set of voices that includes Jewish organizations because many Californians believe that academic freedom is an important component of democracy. Capitulating to far-right political actors in California or in the White House is a disservice to our faculty, students, and the public at large. So that's from the faculty union. Thank you so much to them for providing this statement. So listeners, you should know that before I quit the union earlier this year over feeling unheard, I had requested specific dollar figures last year from the CFA about how much of our union dollars were being used to lobby for policies. I was not planning to report on it, and the union released the figures to me for transparency, which I really appreciated. And that's why I am not sharing those figures. However, the union still took issue with me even mentioning that union dollars were used for policymaking and said it was unethical based on the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. So I think it's only fair that listeners can decide that for themselves. And of course, you know, our union is not alone. My social media feed after October 7th was very telling. Some close friends decried Israel's attacks in the days after October 7th, but never bothered to criticize or even just mention the murders, rapes, and hostage abuse by Hamas. simply pitting two groups against each other as if one is made up of purely innocent victims while the other is full of evil, conniving villains just lacks the nuance of real life. And life doesn't work that way. People can't be put in neatly separated boxes. It's fair to say that most Jewish people, including those who are my family members, want peace in the region. And they want to see basic human rights and safe conditions for Palestinians and Israelis. They care about both populations, as I would think or hope that everyone would, just as human beings. But we've seen examples of hate in recent years that feel very much targeted. For instance, I don't remember seeing anyone blame Chinese Americans or even people who live in China for their government's detention and, quote, re-education of up to 1 million people from the Muslim Uyghur community. I didn't see people blame the people of Sudan for its government's mass atrocities against non-Arab populations in Darfur, such as the Fur, Zaghawa, and Masalit communities. And yet, Jewish individuals, even when they criticize the Israeli government, such as Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro or California State Senator Scott Wiener, are blamed for the actions of a government abroad. Shapiro's house was targeted with an arson attack last year, and you may have seen the recent news stories where Wiener was followed and cornered at a public event more recently. And of course, those who are seen to support Israel's right to exist seem to fare far worse. A couple was shot and killed last year while leaving an American Jewish Committee event for young diplomats at the Capitol Jewish Museum. In Colorado, a man was accused of killing one person and injuring a dozen more in a firebomb attack on demonstrators who were showing support for Israel. And all of this has been scary and very disheartening for those of us who have spent much of our lives working on social justice issues. It's made me personally question how inclusive and just a society we truly live in, and how much propaganda and misinformation our society can succumb to without questioning or challenging the information. Several Jewish faculty members told me they were so saddened with our union's positions that they quit. They stopped paying dues. One faculty member who was quoted in early 2023 about her experience with anti-Semitism in a web story for the University Times, which is our campus news site at Cal State LA, she recently reached out to us and asked that her name be removed. She was worried about her family's safety in light of the rise in anti-Semitic assaults like the ones I mentioned earlier. This is not the America I was raised in. People living in fear because of their identity and their faith. The America I know is one where we all recognize and work for the rights of all people in the U.S. and abroad, Palestinians and Israelis alike. We work together across party lines and across nationalities to eliminate society's ills like poverty, hunger, violence, hate. I grew up being told and believing that we're a melting pot of all different cultures that work better together. And I experienced that firsthand as someone who attended Chicago public schools and then moved to the suburbs to attend a fairly diverse middle and high school. I had friends of all political, socioeconomic, and racial backgrounds, and we loved and supported each other. We didn't look for reasons to hate each other or to obliterate each other's countries of origin. The America of my childhood, that is what I'm holding on to. Despite real concerns about all forms of hate, anti-Semitism, anti-Black hate, anti-Asian hate, homophobia, I will not deny my kids the chance to attend events at a synagogue to celebrate not just the Indian holidays, but the Jewish ones too, and to really learn about their roots. In this moment of so many divisions in American life and politics, my hope is that we remember the ideals that we hold dear to as a country, those we want to live by and pass on to our kids. That is the most American thing we can do. You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. The music you heard in the last segment includes The Wind That Shook Barley from the Library of Congress's American Fiddle Tunes collection. Back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. Now we have an interview with John Waters, produced by Jorge Carreon, who just earned his bachelor's degree from Cal State LA. Carreon is a multi-Clio and Telly award-winning bilingual content producer, interviewer, and writer. He spent over 30 years in staff publicity and creative content production roles at major studios and boutique agencies.
Bienvenidos, mi gente. Today, a special episodio indeed. He's been called the Pope of Trash, but for several generations, he's remained the only man who can make bad taste stand as high art. As he nears his 80th birthday, the divine John Waters refuses to head for a rocking chair. For today's episode of Suddenly Jorge, I had the chance to enjoy a rollicking phone call with the legendary filmmaker and author to offer this preview of his radical comedy crusade. Prepare for a Waters event that is as sharp and as triggering as ever. He's not here to lecture. He's here to deliver a sermon to the converted and faithful. Find out why he thinks humor remains the ultimate form of rebellion, why he believes the radical middle is the newest extreme, and discover a few more revelations that just might make you say, ¿Qué diablos? Enjoy la charla.
Definite similarities between the community of Cal State LA where we're located in El Sereno and East Los Angeles and Baltimore.
Well, let me tell you, my audience, I could be in Paris, I can be in Idaho, I can be anywhere, and they're all the same. They're smart, they get dressed up for me, they are funny, and they have a sense of humor about themselves, and they're all ages and sexuality, and they don't even fit in with their own minority.
Let me just start with this. Do you care about words like legacy or nostalgia at this point?
Well, no. I mean, legacy is very nice. I already got more than I'd ever expected in my life. After the Academy Awards Museum show, what more is there? It's not going to get any better, right? I think legacy is a sort of a word that people might use. It would say the word journey, a word that I hate more than any single word in the world. And humbled is my second most hated word. But legacy, it depends on how they use it. I would never say that word, but I'm flattered if people say that about me. And what was the other word?
Nostalgia.
But for some people, I'm proud of the past, but I live in for the future. I can't stand people my age that say we had more fun in the 60s. No, we didn't. They're having just as much fun now being non-binary and scaring gay people.
You know, given your gallery of obsessions and characters that you devised and unleashed over the decades, can you take credit for the advent of reality television stars and today's influencer culture?
Because Absolutely not. I hate reality television. I've never watched one reality show in my life. My people were not really those people. They were scripts I wrote. We didn't live in a trailer. We didn't eat dog shit. No, I'm the opposite of reality TV. Every single word was scripted.
But given the broad parameters of people wanting to be noticed and to be shocking,
I don't watch. That's the one genre I've never seen a reality show in my life. I know people that work on crews of them, and they're not even real either.
Artificial reality for the world of artificial intelligence.
No, my films are the opposite of reality. Mine are completely fictitious, made up screenplays about a world that it only exists in my mind. That's the opposite of reality.
But, you know, yeah. I love this idea that your new show is a sermon, begging the authorities to drop a net on you and your audience. So in this age of hypersensitivity, what is the one extreme that you're most afraid of?
I'm not afraid of extremes. Is humor impaired on the left or right? I'm in the radical middle for the first time in my life. And humor is politics. Humor is terrorism. Humor is how you win a battle, and humor is how you change people's mind. People come to my show to be triggered, but in a good way, because I make fun of the rules that I and my audience live by, not our parents. And our world now has more rules than my parents did.
But is there any net that you're afraid of now at all?
And I still think it's a free country. I make jokes about, you know why I get away with it? No one ever... I make fun of myself first.
Now you,
and I think that's very, very important. I'm not lecturing anybody. I'm giving a sermon, but it's to the converted. And I'm basically asking you to go more extreme, to use humor to change people's minds. I'm not asking you to be a separatist. I'm not asking you to say gay is better than straight or any politics, but go beyond that. And then we can change things altogether.
What would be one of the cures you would devise to help those who were terminal of too normal?
Well, to show them that all the Fox women in the Republican Party are female impersonators.
Now, you need to explain that one a little bit more to me, because I love
it. Look at them. They're in drag. They all look exactly the same, like an adult star in Los Angeles.
You're encouraging audiences to play phony, incendiary book titles and libraries.
Yeah, that's great. But like, what abortion is... tips for Catholics, wiping issues, you're not alone. Just put fake covers like that in libraries that have been taking out censoring books and hide them on there just to make people go crazy.
Right. You have this roll call of fans from Diesels with Measles and Butch Twinks, all of them were represented in the community and more. You know, how do you think the John Waters fan has evolved since Pink Flamingos? Do you think it's harder to shock today's modernistas versus the culturistas?
You know, my 70s? Trying to shock has never been my goal. My goal is to make people laugh at their ability to be shocked. That's completely different. It's easy to shock people, but it's not funny. It's not witty. It doesn't change anything.
Was that always the intent from day one, or no? Was there something a little more profound for you? Was there a profundity that you were trying to express?
Trying to make you laugh at things that you were uncomfortable about laughing with, and then you maybe look at it in a different way. All good humor takes you to some kind of edge that you're a little uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of a feel-good joke?
Well, then we wouldn't have Bob Hope.
He wasn't that feel good either, really.
Actually, I think he was kind of performative myself. And then I think
maybe Bob Newhart was a feel good comedian.
I would have to agree with that. Now, you say that we should fight back with a limp wrist fist.
Yeah.
How can satire?
Let's admit everything they're uptight about. Yes, we recruit people. There's a young one. Get them. Suck out their blood, and maybe we can use it if Iggy Pop goes on life support.
Do you think
that's a line from the show? I just gave away information in my show.
And people, I hope you're taking notes. I hope people are writing this down because I want them to support.
No, I hope they're not, because then they've heard the joke. I won't give you any more.
But can satire endure while we remain in this current state of hypersensitivity?
It has to, of course. But yes, it can. Yes, it's every day there's satire. Look online. Look on Instagram. There's thousands of ludicrous things that they do to protest and make satire and make the enemy look stupid. Yes.
But I worry that because we're kind of like at this low point of critical thinking that people can't tell the difference anymore.
I've learned not to go for clickbait.
You think you can survive in an artificial intelligent world now, because now we can't even tell the difference between that either. It's like people invent shit to the point.
Here's what I feel about that. Yes, I'm going to survive. Maybe AI will discover the cure of cancer. I'm not joking.
You're not. I know you're not. That's the best part. That makes it fascinating.
So I don't care about anything else. If it makes me live with AI, I'm all for it.
Now, so your style remains without compare, and you're promising to be dressed to thrill for that evening. In a world of fast fashion and sweatpants, is dressing well the ultimate act of rebellion?
Well, that's the only thing Trump was right about, to bitch about how people dress on planes. It enrages me. I have a little card that says nice outfit. I've only handed it to one person because they punch you. But the slobism that I see on airplanes, and I'm on an airplane often every day, is contemptible.
If going to extremes is the goal, what's the one thing you haven't done yet because it's even too extreme for you?
not that I haven't done anything too extreme. There's things I haven't done that I want to do with writing still. There's no extreme, like, act. No sex act. You know, I'm not, I'm trying to think. I'm not rushing to think of some sex act I've never done at 80. No. I would have done that a long time ago.
You're traveling the country. You're bringing this message from the Mount to all of your adoring fans and worshipers. And I'm curious.
Well, you said that. I wouldn't call them that, but go ahead.
But I'm curious. You know, we saw Francis Ford Coppola bring an entire life's work to the screen with Megalopolis. It was meant to be this magnum opus of all that he needed to say at this point in his life with that film. And I'm curious, is that something that you want to do still? Do you want to kind of...
I still want to make movies, but I'm not selling my houses to do it. I'll tell you that much.
So is it fair to say that there is still...
I'm not ever using my own money to make a movie. You never should. I never have. And many of the people that were friends I borrowed money from all got it back. The studios didn't all, but by now, most of them did.
Can the John Waters film survive this new era of filmmaking?
Well, they already have. More people know my films now than they ever did. My audience is half people that weren't even born when I made my last movie, much less the first one.
So can we expect something soon, hopefully?
No, a movie? No. I was going to make Liar Mouth. It fell through. I was going to make Fruitcake, which is my children's Christmas animation movie. That fell through. But you're going to expect something. I've got more jobs than I've ever had in my life. You're going to expect books. You're going to another. I did 59 shows on the road last year.
I think we deserve at least one incredible piece of advice for longevity because, sir, you really are a testament to so many wonderful things that give joy. And I think right now we all need a strategy for joy in a very complicated world.
Well, everything is too long except life. So whatever you do artistically, cut it just a little bit shorter.
Thanks for making this laugh, Mr. Waters. It's been a real privilege speaking with you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
And thanks for watching, mi gente. Hasta pronto.
You have been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show provides news about issues affecting the undercovered areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. I hosted and produced this episode, and I'm the executive producer of the show, along with professors Joanne Lightford and April Brown. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks go to our other Cal State LA faculty and staff, Michael Clark, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Andrew Gampa, Chanel Curry, Julian Reyes, Eliel Beltran, Jeff Hoost, and Jesus Cruz. From all of us at Cal State LA, thank you so much for listening.
There are many ways to support the programs that you love on KPFK. Becoming a member, starting a monthly gift, donating a vehicle that you don't need anymore. And now, donating a piece of land or other real estate. More about the advantages of donating real estate is at kpfk.org.
Point seven KPFK.